Ask Me MD, medical school for the real world, with the MD, Dr. DJ Verrett.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of Ask Me MD, medical school for the real world. I'm Dr. DJ Verrett. Today I have the great pleasure of interviewing Dr. Dan Baker. Dan had a 20-year career in academic medicine as a rheumatologist, left and went to Big Pharma, ultimately becoming a vice president of immunology at Johnson & Johnson. After retiring from Johnson & Johnson, he is now CEO of a startup biotech company. We'll be talking to Dan about his travels through non-clinical medicine right after this.
Ask Me MD, medical school for the real world.
We're talking to Chris Hansen today from Alliance Bank. Chris, tell us about your bank.
DJ, thanks so much for having us. So Alliance Bank is a 95-year Texas-only bank. My office in McKinney services Collin County and surrounding counties. Our three primary niches I would identify are commercial real estate, residential real estate, and healthcare lending.
And how can physicians learn more about the bank?
My email address is chansen, which is chansen at alliancebank.com.
And check them out on the web, alliancebank.com. Welcome back to Ask Me MD, medical school for the real world. I'm Dr. DJ Verrett, and today I have the great pleasure of being joined by Dr. Dan Baker, rheumatologist and current CEO of Kura Biotech. Dan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you have an extremely interesting path through medicine where you were in academics and all the way to today actually running a pharmaceutical company. Can you kind of fill our listeners in on that path?
Sure. So yeah, I trained in medical school at the University of Pennsylvania, and then I stayed and did my fellowship through my fellowship there. Stayed on the faculty at Penn and some other medical schools around town, and for about 19 years, and did the whole academic thing with the lab and a clinic and taught fellows, those kinds of things. And about 2000, I left to go to the old CentiCor, which is which at the time was starting to develop Remicade. And I did that in clinical research for almost 19 years, with some time in basic research as well. Then you may know that CentiCor got bought out and acquired by Janssen. So I was a employee of Johnson & Johnson for almost 20 years. In early 2019, I decided to retire for a bunch of reasons. But I took on the CEO position for this little company that we started in Australia, and I really love it. And so I've sort of gone from being in academic medicine out to being in a startup company for drug development.
What's most interesting to me is you kind of have very unique perspectives, being basically having a career in academics, a career in big pharma, and now in the startup world. Why did you choose to kind of follow the non-clinical path after such a long time in academic medicine?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, in academics, we always are thinking about other things. I looked at jobs in industry a couple of times, but then there came a point in my life that things just kind of came together, and some personal issues and some professional issues, and I just decided it was time to move on. Part of that was, I have to say, was financial. You know, my kids were starting to college, and as a rheumatologist in academic medicine, it's your compensation is not all that great. There were other personal issues and professional issues that sort of pushed me. I didn't really know what I was getting into, I have to say. I was lucky in that I knew the leadership of the companies that I joined. So that made me a little more comfortable. But I have to say it was the best thing I ever did, both for my professional career and for my family. But I was lucky in lots of ways.
Now, you mentioned it was difficult. Was there anything that you did to kind of prepare for that transition in from academic medicine into industry?
I didn't do anything professionally, which I probably should have. One of the things I was able to do, though, was I was able to participate in doing clinical trials for the pharmaceutical companies. And that gives you a bit of an idea of how they work, at least externally, and what they're looking for. There's different parts of pharmaceutical companies, different paths you can take. I took a path in R&D, which is basically research and development. You do clinical trials, those kinds of things. But you can also do medical affairs. You can do safety. And it's always good to at least get as familiar as you can with the company and the leadership, talk to people in industry to understand what it really entails. But I didn't do any specific training to move on.
But it sounds like your academic job kind of was your training, since you were doing clinical trials there and ended up going into the R&D side. And I'm kind of assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, but any one of those jobs in the pharmaceutical industry, you'd need some kind of training or something on your resume to really qualify you for that job and to be looked at for that job. Is that fair to say?
I think that what they're looking for is people who have clinical expertise. I mean, that's really what they want from their MDs when you go into R&D or medical affairs or safety, because they want to have people in the company that have an understanding of the diseases and, you know, what are safety problems, those kinds of things. It's better to have some kind of understanding of trial design and clinical trials. It's not a requisite, but they do like to see people who are accomplished. Often, depending on which companies you're looking at, they'll look for some basic science background, but that's not really necessary. It's really more important to have some understanding of scientific method, those kinds of things, the kinds of things we learn in medical school, and also understand the diseases so that you can sort of be the expert in safety and the clinical diseases that you're in, the areas that you're looking for.
What was the most challenging part of that transition period?
I guess you never really know what you're getting into until you do it and during the situation. You have to be able to adjust to the whole corporate bureaucracy. And, you know, when you join a company, suddenly you're in a very hierarchical system. You have a boss, he has a boss, he or she has a boss, they have a boss. And it's very, very structured in that way. Sometimes you are positioned in a very narrow job. You know, your job responsibilities can be reasonably small when you start. And there's a lot of, it's very different in the sense that you're very driven by objectives. The way the company works is every year, beginning of the year, you write out your objectives for that year, and you're expected to meet them. And if you don't, you are judged on those objectives. And at first, that was a little bit disconcerting, but in the end, it really works because people get things done. And the other thing that's a little hard to get used to is that you're the company's objectives and end game is yours. So you know, you're not seeing patients anymore. You're not doing your research in the lab and following the scientific things that you want. But on the other hand, it's a pretty scientific job. You know, it's pretty scientifically rigorous. It may just not be in the areas that you're interested
in. You had obviously a whole career in quote big pharma, going from being the low man on the totem pole to being one of the big bosses there. Is there something, you mentioned the things that were just different, but was there something fundamentally that surprised you about the way that these drug companies worked?
Well, I guess it was all new to me. Was it surprising? Well, it was. Once I saw how it worked, it made sense. A couple of things were surprising. One of the things was just the amount of bureaucracy. The second thing that's surprising is how much you're regulated. The whole company is very regulated. Everything you do has to be in concert with what the FDA regulations are. They watch over what you do very carefully. And so when you start, there's this huge amount of training courses that you have to take. Most of them are online and it takes forever, but you have to learn what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. Healthcare compliance is a huge thing. And so that kind of regulation surprised me. I see why it's why it's necessary now. But that was one thing that was challenging. Yeah. The way big companies work are that when you enter, you're usually doing work that's in your area of expertise. So I started out doing rheumatoid arthritis and rheumatology, immunology. And I was fortunate enough to be able to move up in the company because we had a very large franchise in immunology. But once you get to a certain level, you may have to move out of your area of expertise. And you may have to be in charge of, for a while I was in charge of GI. Well, this was a new space for me. I had to learn all that, which in a way was really fun. It was a little disconcerting. But what you find is that when the people who make the big decisions, the funding, gives you the money to do the trials that you want to do, often aren't experts at all in the diseases of which you're working. So you may be asking someone who's an infectious disease specialist to approve your trial in rheumatoid arthritis. And sometimes that can be a little bit challenging. They may be experts in trial design and those kinds of things, but they are not experts in rheumatology and the endpoints and those kinds of things. Yeah.
Interesting. So that kind of gives a little bit of a peek behind the curtain on drug development, but it always kind of is strange to me seeing the drug pipelines that certain companies have and how it seems to be fairly limited in certain areas. Maybe can you give us a peek behind the curtain into how drug development decisions are actually made?
Yeah. So especially in big companies, they often want to limit themselves to specific areas where they think they have expertise or where they think the greatest opportunities are. And that's why you'll see most big companies have an oncology space. And then they may choose other areas to have expertise. So, GI, we were big in immunology because over time you learn all the regulations, you learn all the market, you learn, where the opportunities are for what kind of drugs. You know how to do the clinical trials. You know the investigators. You know the regulators. And so often they'll make decisions based on the expertise in the company and the opportunity, the unmet need in the clinic. And then one of the challenges and the challenges for the leadership of the companies are how to distribute the budget. How do you look at immunology and give them X amount of money and take away from cardiology? Those kinds of decisions are sort of big decisions that are often based on what the opportunity is, what the unmet need is, and what the talent within that area of expertise is.
Now, it's also, the drug development timelines are just so long. It takes a number of years to develop them. Give us some insight into how the decisions are made as to what drugs you want to develop, and do you develop them yourselves or do you go out and partner with somebody?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, so most companies will have a lot of companies have their own basic research organization that are basically start out with an idea. You know, they look at targets and they decide whether there's a rational target for a disease that they're interested in. In immunology, that we would have a research organization. We would all get together and say, we should develop an antibody to, this target, or we should develop a small molecule to that target. And then you have to go through actual, making an antibody, targeting, cloning the cells, doing biology to make sure that it works in the animal models. Not that that really matters anymore, because often animal models don't really predict human disease. Then you have to go through safety, toxicology, manufacturing, making sure that through all this, it looks like it's an asset that is going to be able to get into the clinic. And there's many, many times that those kind of, and through development, many, many drop out through stages of development. You can't make it right, or it turns out to be toxic in animals, or it doesn't work in the animal models that you study in disease. So a lot of things drop out that way. And then once you then get a molecule that you can take into humans, then you just have to go slowly into phase one. And often the challenges are when you get into those phase one trials, you hopefully can look for markers that the disease, that the asset is meeting its target and that it's active. But you don't really know until you put in a big investment into a phase two trial to look for efficacy. And for all those reasons, it has become much more attractive to go out and let someone else, a small company, do all that work and then go out and partner. Most companies just find that it's just easier and more profitable to be able to do that rather than develop internally. So for that reason, then that's why there's so many small companies, biotech companies, that are just taking things through to early stage development and then partnering or being acquired by large pharma.
Okay, now having said that about the difficulty of drug development and big pharma not wanting to do it, why did you decide to go ahead and start one of the small drug companies?
Well, I guess one of the great things is, first of all, I like the molecule. I thought it was a really interesting opportunity. And number two, I like the people who were, it came from a small academic group in Sydney, and I liked them and I knew they were good scientists. Thirdly, I liked the lead investment group. I also knew that there were interesting people that I thought I could get on board in the company to develop it. And it was in my area of expertise and my area of interest. So for those reasons, I really was interested in doing it. Now, I have to say, honestly, I'd retired. If it were 20 years ago and I were I was trying to put my kids through college, that would have been a very much different decision. I'm independent of that now, so I can, I'm not necessarily dependent on this being a success to be able to survive financially, I guess that's the way to put it. And I do like the decision-making capabilities. I mean, instead of having to go through seven different committees in a large pharmaceutical company, we can sit down and have some discussions on one afternoon and make decisions about what to do. Yeah.
So you obviously had a learning curve we talked about when you joined the pharmaceutical industry. What kind of learning curve have you had now that you're CEO of a small startup biotech?
Yeah, so first is understanding your investors. You are now you have, you're getting an investment from independent investors usually. Frequently, at least in the groups that we are working with, don't have a lot of scientific background. They do have some, and sometimes they absolutely amaze me with when I understand what their background is. The questions that they ask are terrific. But it's different than dealing with a big pharmaceutical company where you get a budget and and it's also a bigger budget. So there's lots of things you can do in a big pharmaceutical company that you can't do in a small company because your budget isn't as much. And you have to be sure that that money is going to take you to a certain point. So there, you have to be a little bit more strategic about the studies that you do and what you're working toward. The second thing is when you're in a big pharmaceutical company, you are, your objective is to get your molecule into the clinic as safely as possible and as quickly as possible. And it's to get it, into the clinic, through phase three and approved, because that's what big companies do. When you're in a small company, often what you're trying to do is get that molecule through phase one or into phase two and then be able to partner it. Because raising the money to do a big phase three program is very challenging. And with that in mind, then you're really thinking about doing studies that help you increase the value of your molecule. So studies that you don't want to do because, just as a fishing expedition, because it may be negative and you want to, make it look like it's, you don't want to give it a black mark. So it's the strategy is a little bit different, and the strategy of working with the investors and the folks who provide you the finances is different.
And you mentioned a couple of pathways, I guess, in the larger pharmaceutical companies for physicians to become involved. Mm-hmm. Have you seen much involvement by physicians in the startup companies as kind of, I would say, a side gig? You have your daytime job and then you start becoming involved in these smaller companies?
In limited ways, yes. I know that you can do consulting work. So you can, and a lot of the small companies say, I need somebody to help me write this protocol. And they'll get someone who's doing consulting work to literally go through a phase one protocol and say, no, you can't do this, you have to do that, and help them write it. And just on an hourly basis, essentially. So that's one way to get experience. And they'll have people, obviously there's a lot of small companies that need clinical expertise. So, they may, if you have expertise in a certain area of, medicine and they're developing a program in that, they may, have you on the scientific advisory board. And that helps you understand the process and what's going on. And there probably are online training for, how to prepare for large, big pharma. I really did enjoy and learned a huge amount, at Janssen. It was really a big learning experience, and what you understand by the time you walk in day one and you walk away really bodes well for being able to understand the process in small companies and how you need to make your way through the FDA and make your way through all the different early hurdles that come up with molecules as they are being developed.
And I would suspect you mentioned the dollar constraints or the budget constraints of the smaller company. If physicians do become involved, the reimbursement models, the payments are probably a little bit different than the larger companies. I'd expect probably more equity being offered to physicians being involved in the smaller companies than say a Merck or a Janssen or somebody like that?
Yeah, I mean, from a financial perspective, first of all, the salaries won't be as high. Second of all, you know, the long-term compensation that we talk about, which is basically stock options in the company or equity in the company, essentially, are not as great. And they will want you to take equity in small molecule, in small companies. They'd rather have you take equity than an actual cash. And so bonuses that you usually are routine in large companies are just not as frequent in startup companies. There's just not enough money. It is a wonderful thing. And in large companies, that you do get, you know, a reasonable salary, and you get stock options and long-term incentives and a bonus, which, you know, that's how I put my kids through college. I have to be frank. Yeah.
We're talking with Dr. Dan Baker, rheumatologist and current CEO of Kura Biotech. He's been informing us about his experience in non-clinical medicine. You're listening to Ask Me MD. After this quick break, we're going to ask Dr. Baker his top three.
You went car shopping, you meant business. You aced vehicle history searches and test drives. Now you've got your wheels. If you manage that, you can get your retirement plan on track. Visiting aceyourretirement.org can help. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
And we're back with Dr. Dan Baker, rheumatologist and CEO of Kura Biotech. As we do with most of our programs, I'm going to pose a question to Dan of top three things you would tell a physician considering a career in non-clinical medicine. Dan, take it away.
So I thought about this a bit. So I think the first thing to realize is that it's not easy. It's not a vacation. There's a lot of things, a lot of responsibilities. There's a lot of things to learn. And it's a different kind of busy. But it's not easy. I mean, it's not, you're not seeing patients. You can see patients most places, you can see for half a day a week. It's different and it's busy, but it is nice that you have your weekends to yourself. Usually you may have to be doing some work, but you're not on call making rounds. And most of your evenings are free. So that's one thing to realize. It's not a vacation. It's not for everybody. It's not for everybody. I mean, you have to be willing to accept the objectives of the company and work in areas that are going to be outside of your expertise. As I said earlier, I had to lead the psoriasis program at Janssen and the GI program. That can be a little disconcerting, but it also can be kind of fun. You may have to do safety. You may have to do things outside of immunology. If I started in immunology, I've known people that have gone from immunology and done cardiology or infectious diseases. And those are the kind of things you just have to be aware that you may have to move around a bit and do different kinds of things. The culture is different. And one thing you have to get used to is that there's lots of committees to go through. For every protocol that you want to go through, you have to go through a protocol committee, then you have to go through a finance committee, you have to go through probably six or seven different committees, not all of which have the expertise that you have, but they have their own specific areas of expertise. And that can be a little bit, I don't want to say boring, but it just takes longer to get things done. One piece of advice would be that if you're going to join, an awful lot of what your day-to-day life is going to be like is going to depend upon the culture of the company and who your boss is. So you want to be sure that you understand the people that you're going to be working with. You want to get familiar with them, make sure that you talk to people who know them if you can, because a lot of the happiness of your life will be depending upon your boss and the culture of the company. So I think those are the three things I would just be prepared for, that it's there's a lot of bureaucracy, and you need to be able to be flexible and sort of allow your goals and accept the goals of the company to be successful. Yep.
Now, I want to get your response to one last parting thought. I interviewed another physician who's primarily in non-clinical medicine, and one of his top three was make sure you were going towards a new job and not simply away from your clinical practice. What are your thoughts of that?
Yeah, I think that's really important, especially when you are going. I mean, first of all, that's really important that you want to, they actually are anxious to do a new job and to do the job that you're looking at. And that's the first thing that they will ask when you do your interview. You know, why are you leaving? You know, why do you want to do this job? It's a little bit hard because you don't really know what you're getting into until you do it. I mean, that's one of the things that, even though I knew people who were in industry and I knew the people who were my bosses and going to be my bosses, I worked with them in the past in academics, you really don't know what you're getting into until you get there. But you don't want to just say, I got to get out of here, I'm going to go do something different. And you want to be able to understand where you're going and really want to go try it. Yeah, I agree with that.
Dan, thanks so much for your time today. Some great insights into the non-clinical careers you've been involved in.
Thank you very much for having me. It was fun.
We've been talking to Dr. Dan Baker, rheumatologist and current CEO of Cura Biotech. You're listening to Ask Me MD, medical school for the real world. Until next week, make it an awesome week.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Ask Me MD, medical school for the real world with Dr. DJ Verrett. If you have a question or an idea for a show, send us an email at questions@askmemdpodcast.com.